Is this Kinsey?
Sure, who's this?
Iona, my mom said you called looking for me.
Where are you, in creosote?
Peaches, I just got in. What do you want?
Did you talk to Pudgy Clifton Thursday night?
I might have called him, she said cautiously. Why do you ask?
Did you make arrangements to see him?
Why would I do that? He's a low-life punk.
His sister said you were pissed at him. What was that about?
None of your business. That's between him and me.
All right, let's try this one. Your mother tells me you spent time in Lompoc as a kid. I'm wondering if you told Pudgy about the quarry up there. Dead silence.
You remember telling him about that? I'm talking about the one where the girl's body was found. How would I know where the body was found?
Oh, come on, Iona. Don't play games with me. I don't care if you told him. I just want the information.
I might have.
You might have, or you did.
All right, I did. But that was years ago. I even took him to see it once when we were out on the road.
Did you know Charisse Quinn?
No.
Aren't you going to ask who she is?
I'm not stupid. I assume she's the dead girl they found after Kathy Lee was killed. I asked Frankie about that, and he says he had nothing to do with that. He didn't even know her.
You know, he's not stupid either. If he killed the girl, he's hardly going to tell you.
Why are you so against him? Can't you give the guy a break? He hasn't done anything to you.
This isn't about me, Iona. It's about Charisse. Is Frankie there by chance? I'd like to talk to him myself.
He took off Friday morning. He was scheduled to work Friday night and had to get back.
Short visit, wasn't it?
So what? She said, annoyed.
What did you tell him about Pudgy? Another silence, during which I could hear her breathing in my ear.
Iona, if you must know, I told him Pudgy's a fucking snitch. He knew somebody had pointed a finger at him. The minute you mentioned Pudgy, I figured it was him.
Is that why you were so pissed at him?
I'm not the only one. Frankie's pissed about it, too. Pudgy cut a deal for himself by blaming Frankie for what happened to that girl.
I felt a whisper of fear, like a millipede, running down my back. Where'd you get that?
Well, it's true, isn't it?
No.
Yes, it is, because Frankie checked it out. He knows this guy at the county jail who's serving 30 days. The guy told him Pudgy had a visitor, this woman, Private Eye, who was asking about the murder. That was you, right?
Of course, but Pudgy never made a deal.
Yes, he did. You know how I know. He got out of jail the very next day, the guy said.
Because his sentence was up. He'd served his time and he was released.
Nuh-uh, no way. Pudgy went back to his cell block and bragged to everyone. He said you were doing something special for him. Next thing you know, he got out.
He asked me for cigarettes and I said no. That's all it was. There wasn't any deal.
Ha, ha, ha. Tell me another one.
Would you listen to me? Iona, think about this. I don't have the authority to get him out. How would I do that?
That's not what the guy said.
Well, the guy got it wrong. I don't have the power to make a deal with anyone. I'm not a cop. I'm a private citizen, just like you. She said.
Oh.
Yeah, oh, I snapped. Next time you talk to Frankie, would you set him straight? If he needs to hear it from me, he can call. In the meantime, lay off Pudgy. He didn't do a thing. Exasperated, I returned the handset to the cradle. All we needed was Frankie Miracle on a rampage. I had to admit I was really splitting hairs on this one. Pudgy had most certainly pointed a finger at Frankie, but not in order to make a deal for himself. He was hoping to divert our attention, which he'd succeeded in doing, but only temporarily. Now that his fingerprints had showed up on the stolen vehicle, the focus had shifted back to him. His attempt to implicate Frankie only made his own behavior the more suspect, so, in the end, his scheme backfired. Unfortunately, I didn't credit Frankie with an appreciation of the finer points of thinking. To him, a rat was a rat. I checked my notes and picked up the phone again, dialing Felicia Clifton's number in creosote. I didn't even hear the line ring on her end before she said, "Hello? Felicia? Kinsey Milhone, how are you?"
"Not good.
Cedric hasn't come home, and I'm worried sick about him. He hasn't been gone that long, has he? You said he left the house this morning. That's only a few hours. Or he could have gone out last night. All I know is he wasn't here when I got up. Either way, he should have checked in by now. This is not like him. Did you call the tavern? The bartender said he was always there for happy hour. Jerry hasn't seen him either. I don't know where he could have gone. Maybe he met a girl and went home with her. I don't think so. I didn't give him any money, so he didn't even have enough to buy drinks. My car's still here, so he has to be on foot. He could have walked to the tavern, but not anywhere else. You've seen this town. We're out here in the middle of nowhere, and everything shuts down at 6. Have you tried the police? I suppose I could do that, she said reluctantly. I tried the 2 hospitals, the one in Quorum and the other one in Blythe, but neither has a record of him. Well, that's good news, isn't it? I guess. Would he skip town without telling you? You mean take off for good? Why would he do that? He's in a bit of trouble with Frankie Miracle, Iona's ex. Shit! Does Pudgy know that? I'm sure he's well aware of it, so maybe he decided to lay low. Without any money, where could he go? Good question. Look, why not try the police? Maybe he was picked up. For all you know, he's sitting in jail. Trust me, if that was true, he would have hit me up for bail. Well, I hope he shows soon, but if he doesn't, let me know. Maybe we can come up with another idea. You really think he's okay? I'm sure he's fine, but I agree it's worrisome, I said. We chatted briefly, trying to boost each other's confidence. Once I hung up, I thought, who am I trying to kid? I couldn't believe Frankie would risk jail time on a charge of assault and battery, or worse. But he wasn't exactly famous for his impulse control. Now that Iona had set him off, who knew what he'd do? Sunday morning at 8:45, Stacy and I staked out in the parking lot of the Quorum Baptist Church. It was Easter, and most of the women and children we'd seen were decked out in pastel suits and floral dresses, wearing fresh corsages, their hats a-tremble with artificial flowers. The McPhees pulled into the church parking lot in 3 separate cars. We'd been there for half an hour, the rental tucked discreetly behind a 3-foot hedge. I was still arguing it made more sense to go straight to the house, but I think Stacy preferred the drama of doing it this way. The elder McPhees arrived first. They parked and got out, waiting while Adrian turned in behind them and parked her car close by. Shortly afterward, Justine and Cornell arrived with their 3 girls. Dressed in their Sunday best, the 8 of them looked like a picture book family. Edna wore a hat. Rule's hair was slicked down with gel, and his light blue suit was only slightly too big. The 3 girls in matching outfits, complete with hats and white cotton gloves, bypassed the sanctuary and went into the Sunday school building attached at one end. Stacy and I remained where we were. Some of the church windows were open, and we were treated to organ music and an assortment of hymns. The sermon itself didn't carry that far. Stacy had bought a copy of the Palo Verde Valley Times, and while the service went on, we occupied ourselves with the local news. He said, "What'd you hear from Pudgy?" "Not a word. I called last night, but Felicia said he hadn't showed. I'll call again this afternoon. With luck, he'll be back and we can talk to him. I'll bet you money he has a story cooked up to explain his prints on the Mustang." I read the front section in the funnies, and Stacy entertained himself by reading aloud ads for cheap desert real estate. I looked up. "You ought to do it, Stacy. Now that you're a homeless person, you could live down here."
"Too hot. I've been thinking to ask Dolan about moving in with him."
"Hey, I like that. He needs someone to ride herd on his profligate lifestyle."
"I'd have to sneak out for junk food. That's the only thing worries me."
With a rattle, Stacy flipped the page, his attention shifting to sports. "It wouldn't hurt you to cut down."
"Speaking of which, what would you like to try next, Taco Bell, Long John Silver's, or Jack in the Box?"
"I thought we were going to McPhee's."
"I'm talking about later. A fella has to eat."
After the church service ended, we waited until the family headed out and we followed them to the house. Ruhl and Edna turned off a block early. "What's that about? Are they ducking us?" I asked, peering back at them.
"They do that every week. Visit a shut-in before Sunday lunch."
"You're too much," I said. "Is there anything you don't know?" Justine let us in. She and Adrian were apparently in charge of the kitchen until Edna got home. The house smelled of the baked ham she must have put in the oven before she left for church. I detected whiffs of pineapple and brown sugar, and the burnt sugar smell of baking sweet potatoes oozing sap onto the oven floor. Justine's girls had settled at the coffee table in the living room, playing a board game with only minor squabbling. I could see their Easter baskets on the floor where they'd left them. Judging from the bits of crumpled foil, it looked as though the girls had already begun to sample the hollow chocolate bunnies and foil-wrapped chocolate eggs. All three had received bright yellow plush ducks. The dining room table had been set with the good china. The centerpiece was an enormous arrangement of Easter lilies I could smell from where I stood. Justine proceeded down the hall ahead of us.
"We're out here in the kitchen putting the finishing touches on lunch."
"No problem," Stacy said as we followed her. The kitchen was densely heated, in part by the kettle of green beans simmering on the stove. Of course, I was starving, hoping to get on with this so Stacy and I could hit the junk food circuit. I'd already decided it wasn't my job to help Stacy reform. I'd set him on this path, so I might as well keep him company while he stuffed himself. Adrian stood at the counter, twisting plastic ice cube trays so the cubes dropped neatly into a big, clear glass pitcher. She passed each empty tray to Cornell, who refilled it after she handed it to him. He delivered the last tray to the freezer, and then picked up a dish towel and dried his hands. In the meantime, Justine was setting out salad plates, arranging a lettuce leaf on each. She opened the refrigerator and removed a Tupperware Jell-O mold, which she ran briefly under hot water at the sink. Over her shoulder, she said to Stacy, "What did you want?"
"I was hoping your parents would be here so I wouldn't have to repeat myself. I don't know if Lieutenant Dolan mentioned this, but we're going to need a set of fingerprints from each of you. Detective Bancroft at the Sheriff's Department said she'd look for you first thing tomorrow morning."
Cornell leaned against the counter and crossed his arms. He'd taken off his sport coat and loosened his tie.
"What's this about?"
"Elimination purposes. Any one of you might have left prints on the Mustang. This way, if we come up with latents, we'll have something to compare them to. Saves time and aggravation."
"We're supposed to get inked and rolled like a bunch of criminals?" Cornell asked.
"Well, no, sir, not at all. This is strictly routine, but it's a big help to us. Lieutenant Dolan would have told you himself, but he ended up at Quorum General. I suppose you heard about that."
Cornell wasn't to be distracted by Dolan's medical woes.
"What if we say no?"
"I can't think why you would. It's common practice."
"Well, it's not common for me."
Adrian looked at him.
"Oh, just do it, Cornell. Why are you kicking up a fuss?"
"He's not kicking up a fuss," Justine said. "He's asking why we have to agree to this crap."
"I wouldn't go so far as to call it crap," Stacy said. "Left up to me, I'd let the matter slide. But Dolan seems to think it's a good idea. He's the boss on this one. Only takes a couple of minutes, and the place can't be any more than 10 blocks away. If you want, I'll drive you over and bring you back when you're done."
"It isn't that," Cornell said.
"Then what?" Adrian said. "Why are you acting like this?"
"I wasn't talking to you. I want your opinion, I can ask."
"Excuse the heck out of me."
"Look, I'll go down there, okay? I just don't like being told what to do."
Stacy said,
"Tell you what, I've got an inkless pad in the car. Inked prints are superior, but I can see your point. We can take care of it right now if you'd prefer."
"Skip it. I'll go. It just bugs me, that's all."
"We appreciate that. I'll tell the detective the family is coming in."
"Wait a minute. Mom and Dad have to go too?"
"Since the vehicle belongs to your dad, it wouldn't be unusual to find his prints on it. It's the same with your mom. No point in chasing our tails if there's an obvious explanation."
"Oh, for Pete's sake," Cornell said.
He tossed the dish towel on the counter and went out the back door, letting it bang shut behind him. I'd have bet serious money he'd be lighting a cigarette to calm himself. His sister stared after him.
What's his problem?
Just drop it. He's in a bad mood, Justine said.
Adrian caught my eye briefly and then looked away. Stacy and I went to Long John Silver's for lunch, this time swooning over crisp fried fish and chips doused in puckery vinegar the color of iced tea. Afterward, we stopped by Quorum General to visit Dolan. I hadn't seen him since Friday night, and I was amazed at his progress. He was out wandering the hall, wearing a pair of paper slippers and a light cotton robe over his hospital gown. He was freshly showered and shaved, his hair still damp and neatly combed to one side. As soon as he saw us, he said,
"Let's use the waiting room at the end of the hall. I'm sick of being cooped up."
I said, "You look great."
"I'm lobbying the doc to let me out of here."
Dolan seemed to shuffle, but it may have been the only way to keep the slippers on his feet. What's the deal at this point?
Possibly tomorrow. I'm supposed to start cardiac rehab, and he thinks I'm better off doing that on home turf, he said. Joe Mandel called me this morning with good news. They picked up the guy on that triple homicide.
Stacy said,
"Good dang deal. Now they can concentrate on us."
We had the waiting room to ourselves. Up in one corner, a wall-mounted color TV was tuned to an evangelist, the sound turned down low. There was a white-robed choir behind him, and I watched the vigor with which they sang. Lieutenant Dolan seemed restless, but I thought it was probably the lack of cigarettes. For him, work and the act of smoking were so closely connected it was hard to do one without the other. We chatted about the case. None of us ever tired of rehashing the facts, though there was nothing new to add. He said,
"Right now, Pudgy's our priority. Time to lean on that guy." "Waste of time," Stacy said. "He's an old family friend. His prints are easy to explain. Might be bullshit, but nothing we can prove either way."
We moved on to idle chit-chat until Dolan's energy began to flag. We parted company soon afterward. Stacy and I spent the remainder of Sunday afternoon in our separate rooms. I don't know how he occupied his time. I read my book, napped, and trimmed my hair with my trusty pair of nail scissors. At 6 o'clock, we went out for another round of junk food, this time Taco Bell. I was beginning to crave alfalfa sprouts and carrot juice, anything without additives, preservatives, or grease. On the other hand, the color had returned to Stacy's cheeks, and I'd have been willing to swear he'd gained a pound or two since he arrived. Dolan was released from the hospital late Monday afternoon, just as the dinner trays were coming out. Stacy and I arrived on the floor at 5 and waited with patience while Dolan's doctor reviewed his chart and lectured him at length about the importance of staying off cigarettes, eating properly, and initiating a program of moderate exercise. By the time we saw him, he was dressed in street clothes and eager to be gone. We tucked him in the front seat of Stacy's rental car while I climbed in the back. He carried a manila envelope with copies of the ER report, his EKGs, and his record of treatment. As Stacy turned the key in the ignition, Dolan said,
"Bunch of bunk. They exaggerate this stuff, trying to keep you in line. I don't see what's so bad about an occasional smoke." "Don't start on that. You do what they say." "How about I'll be as compliant as you were? As I remember it, you did what suited you, and to hell with them."
Stacy turned off the key and threw his hands up.
"That's it. We're going right back upstairs and talk to the doctor." "What's the matter with you? I said I'd do as I'm told, in the main. Now start the car and let's go. I'm not supposed to be upset. It says so right here," he said, rattling his envelope. "Does not. I read that myself." "You read my medical records?" "Sure. The chart was in the slot on your door. I knew you'd lie about things."
I leaned forward, resting my arms on the front seat between them.
"Guys, if you two are going to bicker, I'll get out and walk."
All three of us were silent while they thought about that. Finally, Dolan said,
"Oh, all right. This is making my blood pressure go up."
At the Quorum Inn over dinner, Dolan's mood improved and the tension between them eased. Dolan made a pious display of ordering broiled fish with lemon, steamed vegetables, a plain green salad, and a glass of red wine, which he swore he was allowed. After our day of junk food, Stacy and I both ate broiled chicken, salad, and the same steamed vegetables. We all pretended to enjoy the dinner more than we did. By the time our decaf coffee arrived, it was clear we'd run out of conversation. In the morning, Stacy would drive Dolan back to Santa Teresa in the rental car, leaving Dolan's for me. The case had sailed into one of those inevitable calms. We were waiting for paperwork, waiting for test results, waiting for comparison prints. In short, waiting for a break that might never come. I probably should have headed home at the same time they did. I'd certainly join them in a day or two, if nothing further developed. I said, "In the meantime, what's left? I don't want to sit here idle." Dolan said,
"Just don't get in trouble."
How could I do that? There's nothing going on. Tuesday morning, I saw them off at 8, giving a final wave as Stacy turned out of the parking lot. I went back to my room feeling a mild depression mixed with relief at being on my own again. I usually experienced a similar reaction after Robert Dietz had been with me and finally hit the road. It's hard to be the one left behind. If I were home, I'd clean house. But in the confines of the motel, I couldn't even do that. I gathered my wee pile of laundry, rooted in the bottom of my bag for loose change, and walked to the laundromat half a block away. There is no activity more profoundly boring than sitting in a laundromat waiting for the washer and dryer to click through their cycles from beginning to end. If you dared leave your clothes thinking to return later when the load was done, someone would steal them or pull them out of the machines and leave them in a heap. I sat and did surveillance on my own underwear. It beat doing a record search, but not by much. Chapter 24. I hadn't been back from the laundromat for more than 10 minutes when I heard a knock on my door. I peered through the fisheye and saw Felicia Clifton standing outside, staring off across the parking lot. I opened the door. The face she turned to me was pale and undefined, free of makeup. Her eyes, without the black liner and false lashes, were actually prettier, though not nearly as large or as vivid. She wore jeans, a sweatshirt, and running shoes without socks, as though she'd dressed in haste. Her red hair was pulled back in a jumbled ponytail. "This is a pleasant surprise. Come in." She stepped in, reaching out a hand to steady herself. At first I thought she was drunk, but I realized within seconds she was shaken and upset. "Felicia, what's wrong? Is it Pudgy?" She nodded mutely. I moved her to one side and closed the door after her, saying, "Hey, you're safe, you're fine. Take your time." She sank onto the desk chair, putting her head between her knees as though on the verge of passing out. So far, I didn't like the way the conversation was shaping up. I went into the bathroom and grabbed a washcloth. I wrung it with cold water and carried it back to her. She took it and pressed it to her face. She made a sound that was half sigh and half moan. I sat down at the foot of the king-size bed, almost knee to knee with her. "Is he all right?" From the way she was behaving, I suspected he was dead, but I was unwilling to voice that possibility until she did.
"They called at 7. They think it's him. They need someone to look. But I can't."
"What happened?"
"I don't know. They told me to come in."
"Where? The sheriff's department downtown?" She nodded.
"This is bad. He's been gone for days. If he was hurt, they wouldn't ask me to come in, would they? They'd tell me where he was."
"You don't know that for sure. Did they call you at work?"
"I was still at home. I don't start until 8. I was having a cup of coffee in my robe when the phone rang. I don't even know how I got here. I remember getting in the car, but I don't remember the drive."
"We'll go. Leave your car where it is and we'll take mine. Just let me grab my things. In the meantime, breathe." I breathed in and out for her, demonstrating the process. I knew her anxiety was such that she'd end up holding her breath. Jacket and bag in hand, I ushered her out and pulled the door shut behind us. She didn't have a purse, and her hands were shaking so badly the car keys she carried jingled like a length of chain. I put a hand out to still them. She looked at me in surprise and then stared down at the keys as though she'd never seen them before. She tucked them in her jeans. I opened the passenger door for her, then circled the car and slipped in under the wheel. Once I started the car, I turned the heat on full blast. The day wasn't cold, but she was so tense I knew she'd be feeling chilled. She sat, shoulders hunched, pressing her hands between her knees while she shook like a dog on the way to the vet's. The police department and sheriff's department were housed together in a two-story brick building, which, like everything else in Quorum, was hardly more than 7 blocks away. I found parking on the street and went around to the passenger door to help her out. Once she was on her feet, she regained some of her composure. I knew she was still rattled, but something about being in motion helped her assume control. So far, she really hadn't heard any bad news. It was the anticipation that was crushing her. We went into the station. I had Felicia take a seat on a wooden bench in the corridor while I went into the office. This was strictly no-fuss decor. A counter, plain beige floor tile, gray metal desks, rolling swivel chairs, and government-issue gray filing cabinets. Cables and connecting wires ran in a tangle from the backs of the computers and down behind the desks. A cork bulletin board was littered with memos, notices, and official communications I couldn't read from where I stood. There were also framed color photographs of the Riverside County Sheriff, the Governor of California, and the President of the United States. I told the uniformed deputy at the desk who Felicia was and why we were there. He referred me, in turn, to a Detective Lassiter who emerged from the inner office to have a chat with me. He was in his 40s, clean-shaven, trim, and prematurely gray. He was dressed in civilian clothes, gun and holster visible under his dark gray sport coat. He kept his voice low while he detailed the information he'd received. "We got a call from a woman who lives out on Highway 78, 4 miles this side of Hazelwood Springs. Are you familiar with the area?" "I know the section of road you mean." "There are coyotes in the hills near her property, so she leaves her dog inside unless she can be in the yard to keep an eye on him. Yesterday, the trash haulers left the gate open and the dog escaped. He was gone all night, and when he came back this morning, he was dragging a bone. Actually, an arm." The deputy remembered Felicia's call about Cedric. "Most of us know him, but we want someone else to take a look." I really only met him once, and I'm not sure I'd recognize his arm. "Unless it's the one with all the tattoos," I added. I had a quick vision of his left arm from the one and only time I'd seen him at the Santa Teresa County Jail. On it, he'd had a tattoo of a big-breasted woman with long, flowing black hair. In addition, he had a spider web, the sombrero-clad skull, and a pornographic sex act he would have been well advised to have tattooed on his butt. "We had a warrant out on him for a traffic-related felony. This was 1981. Along with his mugshot, we have a description of his tattoos that seems to match."
"Can't you use the hand to roll a set of prints?"
"Most of the fingers have been chewed, but we'll try that as soon as the coroner's done whatever he needs to do."
"Where's the rest of him?"
"That's just it. We don't know."
I stared at him, blinking, startled by the notion that had just popped into my head. I might. Intuition is odd. After one of those gut-level leaps, you can sometimes go back and trace the trajectory, how this thought or observation and yet another idea have somehow fused at the bottom of your brain to form the insight that suddenly rockets into view. On other occasions, intuition is just that. A flash of information that reaches us without any conscious reasoning. What I remembered was the sound of plastic being flapped by the wind, and a coyote leisurely stripping flesh from what I'd assumed at the time was a recent kill. "I think he's at the Thule, Belle. The scavengers have been dining on him for days." Felicia and I sat in the car for an hour on the upwind side of the abandoned complex. By now the odor of putrefying flesh was unmistakable, as easily identified as the smell of skunk. We waited while the coroner examined the remains. The coyotes must have picked up on the scent of blood within hours, and many of Pudgy's facial features had apparently been ravaged. It was that aspect of his death that seemed to offend even the most cynical of the officers present. Pudgy's troubles with the law had occurred with a frequency that had created something of a bond with many of the deputies. Granted, he was a screw-up, but he was never vicious or depraved. He was simply one of those guys for whom crime came more easily than righteous effort. Eventually, Detective Lassiter came over to the car and asked Felicia if she wanted to see the body.
"He's not in good shape, but you're entitled to see him. I don't want you left with any doubts about this."
She glanced at me. "You go. I won't look if it's that bad."
It was. Pudgy's body had been covered with a length of opaque plastic sheeting, weighted with rocks, and left in a shallow depression out behind the very building I'd toured. Even as I approached the area with Detective Lassiter, I could hear the wind pick up a corner of the plastic and flap it like a rag. I said, "Where'd the plastic come from?"
"It was tacked across a doorway at the rear of this wing. You can see the remnants where it was torn from the doorframe."
The glimpse I had of the body was sufficient to confirm that it was Pudgy. No surprise on that score. The cause of death was blunt force trauma, repeated blows to the head that had fractured his skull and left a lot of brain matter exposed.
"What about the murder weapon?"
"We're looking for that now."
There was no immediate estimate as to time of death. That would wait until the coroner did the post-mortem. Felicia had last seen him Friday night between 9:30 and 10 when she'd turned off the TV and had gone to bed. He might well have been killed that night, though it was unclear how he got to the Thule Bell. Odds were someone had picked him up in Creosote and driven him out here, probably someone he trusted, or he wouldn't have agreed to go. I wondered how long it had taken the coyotes to arrive, their knives and forks at the ready, bibs tucked under their little hairy chins. The hawks and crows, foxes and bobcats would have waited their turns. Nature is generous. Pudgy, in death, was a veritable feast. The area had been secured. Anyone not directly involved was kept at a distance to preclude contamination of the scene. The coroner's van was parked close by. Detective Lassiter had organized the deputies, and they'd started a grid search, looking for additional bones and body parts as well as the murder weapon and any evidence the killer might have left behind. Deputy Chilton, whom I'd met at the McPhees, was one of the men combing the surrounding area. Felicia and I sat in Dolan's car. Technically, she wasn't required to be there at all, and I suspect the detective would have preferred that I ferry her home. At the station, while we'd waited, they'd sent a unit out to the Thule Bell to check my guess. The deputy had spotted Pudgy's body and called in the report. Felicia had been given a vague accounting, enough to know it was her brother, and the condition of his body poor. She'd insisted on coming. He was far beyond rescue, but she kept her vigil nonetheless. I watched the crime scene activity as if it were a movie I'd already seen. The details sometimes varied, but the plot was always the same. I felt sick at heart. I avoided thinking about the coyotes and the sounds I'd heard on the two occasions I had been at the Thule Bell. There was no doubt in my mind that he was dead by then. I couldn't have saved him, but I might have prevented some of the mauling that came later. The fact that Pudgy was killed here lent support to my suspicion that Charisse had been killed at this location as well. At 2, Detective Lassiter crossed the wide, unpaved parking area and again headed in our direction. I got out of the car and went to meet him midway.
"They're getting ready to transport the body. You might have Felicia call the mortuary in Quorum. Once the autopsy's done, we'll release the body to them, unless she's made other arrangements. You might ask if she has a pastor she wants us to notify."
"Sure, I'll see what she says."
"You're down here with Stacy Oliphant?"
"Right. He and Lieutenant Dolan are on their way back to Santa Teresa. I was scheduled to follow, but under the circumstances, I'll stay."
"We'll operate on the assumption the two murders are related unless we find out otherwise. I imagine Santa Teresa will want to send down a couple of their guys."
"Most certainly," I said.
I gave him my summary of what had brought us to Quorum and what we'd learned. Since Stacy had relayed much of the same information, I skimmed across events, only filling in details when I came to something he hadn't heard, Frankie Miracle being prime. I said, Lieutenant Dolan and I dropped in on his ex-wife and Peaches as we were heading down to the desert. Her name's Iona Mathis. We're familiar with her, he said. She and my niece belong to the same church, or at least they did. Yeah, well, her mom says she drove to Santa Teresa to see Frankie as soon as we left. I thought he drove back with her, but I'm not sure. She claims he was at work Friday night in Santa Teresa. Easy enough to check. You know the company? I don't, but I'm sure Stacy or Dolan will know. You might want to talk to Iona as well. She called Pudgy Thursday night and was really pissed off from what Felicia said. I made a verbal detour, telling him about Iona's belief that Pudgy'd made a deal for himself at Frankie's expense. Felicia doesn't know if Pudgy went out late Friday night or first thing Saturday morning. She told me a call came in before Iona's, but she has no idea who it was. He answered that one himself. I'll talk to Iona soon, maybe later today. Where will you be? I told him where I was staying. I'll call the guys as soon as I get back to the motel. This business with Pudgy will be a blow. I'm sure Stacy told you they found his prints on the Mustang. We all assumed he either killed her himself or else knew who did. Now it looks like someone killed him to shut him up. The downside of being an accessory, Lassiter said. Meanwhile, if anything comes up, let us know. I drove Felicia back to the motel. She was quiet, leaning her head against the seat with her eyes half closed. She had a tissue in one hand, and I could see her dab at her eyes occasionally. Her lids were swollen and her face was splotchy, her red hair lusterless as though dulled by grief. Whatever weeping she did was silent. Now that she knew the worst, there was something passive in her response, a resignation she must have harbored for years, waiting for the blow. Finally, I said, "If it's any consolation, people did care about him." She turned and smiled wanly. "You think? I hope you're right about that. He had a sorry life. In jail more times than he was out. Makes you wonder what it means." "I've given up trying to figure that out. Just don't blame yourself." "I do, in some ways. I'll always think I could have done a better job with him. Trouble is, I don't know if I was too tough on him or not tough enough." "Pudgy made his choices. It's not your responsibility." "You know something? I don't care what he did. He was decent to me. He might have sponged, but he never ripped me off, you know? He's my baby brother, and I loved him." "I know. You belong to a church? I'd be happy to make some calls." "In a town this size, the word's already out. The minister will probably already be there by the time I get home. I just hope I don't fall apart. This is hard enough." At the motel, I parked near her car, and the two of us got out. I gave her a hug. She clung to me briefly. Then she pulled back, eyes brimming, and wiped her nose on a tissue. "Don't be too nice. It only makes it worse," she said. "You're okay to drive?" "I'll be fine. I'll call you tomorrow." "Thanks. I'd appreciate that." I let myself into my room. The maid had come and gone, so my towels were fresh, and my bed had been neatly made. I stretched out, reaching for the phone next to my book on the bed table. Stacy's number was a disconnect. I had to smile at that. Since he'd been convinced he was dying, he probably hadn't worried much about utility bills. I called Dolan's number and left a message, asking one or the other of them to give me a call as soon as they rolled in. It was 3 by then, and even if they'd stopped for lunch, they should arrive in Santa Teresa within the hour. I didn't dare leave the room, for fear I'd miss their call. I tried reading, but I found myself, not surprisingly, brooding about Pudgy's death. I thought about my conversation with Iona Mathis, wondering how she'd come up with that cockamamie notion that I'd made a deal with Pudgy to get him out of jail. I hoped her misconceptions hadn't contributed to his death. If so, then I bore a certain responsibility for what had happened to him. The thought made me ill. I took my shoes off and slid under the covers, pulling the spread over me. I picked up my book and read for a while, hoping to distract myself. I was warm. The room was quiet. I found myself dipping into sleep, so that when the phone finally rang, I jumped, snatching up the handset while my heart thumped. The surge of adrenaline peaked and receded. It was Dolan. I sat up and trailed my feet over the side of the bed, rubbing my face while I suppressed a yawn. "How was the trip? You sound tired."
"I felt perkier," he said. "Stacy dropped me off half an hour ago. He's taking a run to the sheriff's department to talk to Mandel. On his way back, he plans to stop by his apartment and pick up his things. I guess we'll think about dinner after that."
"Is he staying with you?"
"Temporarily. You know, the lease is up on his place, and he has to be out by the end of the month. He assumed he'd be 6 feet underground by then, but I guess the gods fooled him. I asked him if he wanted to stay here until he finds someplace else. I can use the company."
"Nice. That should benefit both of you if you can keep from quarreling." Dolan had the good grace to laugh.
"We don't quarrel. We disagree," he said. "What about things on your end? We felt bad you got stuck holding the proverbial bag. Did you manage to amuse yourself?"
"Funny you should ask." And then I told him about Pudgy's death, which we discussed in detail. In the midst of dissecting events, Dolan said,
"Hang on a second. Stacy just came in. I want to tell him about this."
He put his hand across the mouthpiece to spare me the replay while he brought Stacy up to speed. Even in its muffled form, I could hear Stacy's expletives. He took the handset from Dolan.
"That's the last time I'm leaving you. What the hell's going on?"
"You know as much as I do." He had his own set of questions about Pudgy, and then we chatted about Frankie. He said they'd do what they could to track him down and see if he could account for his whereabouts from Friday morning on.
"Good news on this end. Charisse's dental chart is a match for Jane Doe's, so at least we nailed that down. Forensics is just about willing to swear the hairs we recovered belonged to her as well. Now all we need is a match on that second set of prints, and we may be in business. Have the McPhees gone in?"
"I assume so. I'll check tomorrow morning to make sure," I said. "When are you planning to drive back?"
"Soon as I can. I'll hit the road the minute things here are under control."
I heard Dolan rumbling in the background. Stacy said,
"Oh, right. Dolan left his gun in the trunk of his car. He wants to know if it's still there."
"I haven't had occasion to open the trunk, but I'll look when I can. What's he want me to do with it?" Dolan said something to Stacy.
"He says make sure you get it back to him as soon as you get home."
"Of course." Dolan said something else to him that I couldn't make out. Stacy said,
"Hang on a minute." And to Dolan, "Damn it, would you quit talking to me when I'm on the phone with her?"
More mumbling from Dolan.
"Horsepucky, you will not," Stacy returned. "Guy's driving me nuts. He says he'll do fine on his own, but he's full of shit. Minute my back is turned, he'll run out and buy himself a pack of cigarettes. They ought to lock him up."
I heard a door slam in the background.
"Same to you, bub," Stacy yelled. "Anyway, I'll call and let you know when I'm hitting the road. You can talk to the desk clerk and reserve a room."
After we hung up, I put a call through to Henry. His machine picked up. I left a message telling him I missed him and that I'd call back. I read for another hour or so and then ordered a pizza. I didn't have the heart to go out and eat a proper meal by myself. Ordinarily, I like eating in a restaurant alone. But with Stacy and Dolan gone, the idea seemed alien. Pudgy's murder had left me spooked. It was one thing dealing with a murder that had happened 18 years before. Whatever the motivation, time had provided a lengthy cooling-off period. Life had gone on. The killer had managed to strike once and get away with it. I'd assumed there wouldn't be a reason to kill again, but Pudgy's death made it obvious how wrong I was. The stakes were still high. In the intervening years, someone had enjoyed a life that was built on a lie. Now we'd come along threatening the status quo. I ate my supper and tossed the box in the trash. I watched a couple of television shows with annoying laugh tracks. At 9, I decided I might as well work, keeping a systematic set of notes as its soothing side effects. I sat down at the desk and opened the drawer. Things had been moved. I stared, and then I looked around the room, wondering if someone had come in. Not if. I wondered who'd come in and handled the contents of the drawer. The last time I'd taken notes must have been Saturday afternoon. Stacy and I had been to Creosote, stopping off at the Tule Bell on the way home. Once at the motel, we'd decided to take a break. I'd had a phone chat with Betty Puckett from Lockerbie, and then I'd showered, dressed, and started jotting down the tidbits, events, questions, and conversations. At the end of that session, I'd put a rubber band around my index cards and tossed them in the drawer on top of the murder book. Now they were underneath. It seemed a small matter, but my memory was distinct. I picked up a pen and used it to lift one corner of the murder book so I could slide the cards out. I held the stack along the edges while I peeled off the rubber band. I'd left the top card upside down as a reminder to myself to have a second chat with Medora Sanders. Now the card was reversed, lined up in the same direction as all the other note cards. Someone had been in here. Someone had handled the murder book and read my notes. I got up abruptly, almost as though a shock had been administered through the seat of my chair. I circled the room, carefully scrutinizing every square foot of it. My duffel and the family photo album were in the closet, untouched. Except for what was in the drawer, everything else was as I remembered it. Had the maid tidied up? If so, why would she stop and read the index cards? The maid I'd chatted with had barely spoken English. It could have been another employee. They were probably different women who worked weekday and weekend shifts. Maybe the last maid who cleaned my room had been curious and had helped herself, thinking I'd never know. I had trouble believing it, but I couldn't prove otherwise. I rebanded the cards and returned them, using the tip of my pen to push the drawer shut. I didn't think it would occur to anyone that I'd have such a clear recollection of how the contents of the drawer had been left. If it wasn't the maid, then how had entry been effected? The room door was kept locked. I went into the bathroom and pulled a tissue from the box, then moved to the door and used the tissue to turn the knob. I examined the exterior of the door, the escutcheon and the faceplate, but there were no gouges or scratches and no evidence of forced entry. The windows were latched on the inside and showed no indications of tampering. On the other hand, the means of access could have been simple. While the maid had been cleaning the room on Saturday, she left my door propped open with a pile of dirty sheets. She'd had her radio on in the bathroom, music blaring while she cleaned the toilet and the sink. Anyone could have slipped in and searched the desk, which was just inside the door. There wouldn't have been time to read the murder book itself, but the cards were more important. My notes reflected everything I knew about the case and everything I considered relevant. By perusing my notes, someone could figure out where I'd been, who I'd talked to, and what I intended to do. There was an obvious advantage to anticipating my next move. Someone could step in before I had had the chance to get the information I needed. I closed the door and went back to the desk. I studied the stack of cards with Medora's name on top. I didn't think she knew anything she hadn't told me before. Might be smart to check in with her. Briefly, I considered calling Detective Lassiter or someone else at the local sheriff's department. But what was I supposed to say? My stack of index cards had been moved an inch? Gasp! I didn't think they'd rush right out and dust for prints. At best, they'd come up with the same suggestion I had, that the maid had opened and closed the drawer in the process of cleaning my room. Big deal. Aside from the rearrangement of my belongings, which they'd have to take my word for, there wasn't any evidence of a break-in. The room hadn't been vandalized and nothing had been stolen, so from their perspective, no crime had been committed. I grabbed my bag and my bomber jacket, preparing to leave. I was almost out the door when something occurred to me. I retrieved my family album from the closet and then crossed to the desk drawer and removed the murder book and the index cards. I went out, making sure the door was secured behind me. I locked my armload of valuables in the trunk of Dolan's car and then headed for Medora's house. I was heartened by the lingering image of Dolan Smith & Wesson in the trunk. Chapter 25. The night was cold and windy, but the drive was so brief there wasn't time enough for Dolan's heater to kick in. There was scarcely a building in Quora more than 2 stories tall, so there wasn't much protection from the blasts of chill air sweeping in off the desert. The sky was a brittle black, and the presence of stars wasn't as comforting as one might hope. Nature has her little ways of reminding us how small and frail we are. Our existence is temporary, while hers will go on long after our poor flesh has failed. I parked in Medora's driveway. The house was dark except for one lamp in the living room. As I crossed the patchy stretch of grass, I realized the front door was standing open. I could see the vertical strip of dull light expand and contract as the wind ebbed and flowed. I hesitated and then knocked on the screen door frame. "Medora!" There was no sound from inside. I opened the screen door and called through the opening. "Medora!" I didn't like the idea of intruding, but this was odd, especially given my suspicions about an intruder of my own. If someone had read my notes and spotted her name, her house might well be the next stop. I pushed the door open and eased in, closing it behind me. The room was dark except for a small table lamp. I could see Medora on the couch, lying on her back, her hands folded across her chest. I drew closer. She was snoring, her every exhalation infused with the fumes of metabolizing alcohol. If she woke to find me hovering, she'd be startled, but I didn't want to leave until I knew she was okay. A half-smoked cigarette resting on the lip of the ashtray had burned down to an inch of ash before it had gone out. The ice in her highball glass had long since melted away. Her prescription pill bottles appeared to be full, and the caps were in place. At least she hadn't overdosed in any obvious way, though I knew her practice of mixing whiskey with painkillers was dangerous. The house was cold, and I could feel a breeze stirring. I crossed to the kitchen and flipped on the light. The back door stood open, creating a cross-ventilation that had drained all the heat from the rooms. I lifted my head and scanned the silence for any hint of sound. I remained where I was and did a visual survey. The back door was intact, no splintered wood, no shattered framing, and no broken glass. The windows were shut and the latches turned to the locked position. The kitchen counters were crowded with canned goods, boxes of cereal and crackers, packages of paper napkins, toilet tissue, paper towels, and cleaning products. It looked as if the dishes hadn't been done in a week, though all she seemed to eat was cereal and soup. The trash can was overflowing, but aside from the mess, it didn't appear that anything had been disturbed. I glanced over at Medora, chilled by the notion of how vulnerable she was. Anybody could have walked in, robbed her, assaulted her, killed her where she lay. If a fire had broken out, I doubt she'd have been aware. I closed the back door and locked it. I toured the rest of the house, which comprised no more than one small dingy bathroom and 2 small bedrooms. Her housekeeping habits, such as they were, made it impossible to tell if anyone else had been in the rooms doing a quick search. I returned to the living room and leaned toward her. "Medora, it's Kinsey. Are you all right?" She didn't stir. I placed a hand lightly on her arm, saying, "Hey." Nothing. I shook her gently, but the gesture didn't seem to register. She was submerged in the murky depths of alcohol where sound couldn't penetrate and no light reached. I shook her again. She made a grunting noise, but otherwise remained unresponsive. I didn't think I should leave her in her present state. I looked for a telephone and finally spotted one in the kitchen, mounted on the wall near the hall door. I searched one drawer after another until I found the phone book. I looked up Justine's number and called her. She answered after 4 rings. "Justine, this is Kinsey. I'm really sorry to bother you, but I stopped by your mother's house just now and found both doors standing open. She seems to have passed out. I think she's okay, but I'm having trouble rousing her. Could you come over here? I don't think I should leave her until you've seen for yourself.
Damnation! Oh, hell! I'll be there as soon as possible.
She hung up abruptly. I was sorry I had annoyed her, but such is life. I returned to the couch and perched on the edge of the coffee table. I took Medora's hand and slapped it lightly.
Medora, wake up. Can you wake up?
Groggily, she opened her eyes. At first, she couldn't seem to focus, but she finally coordinated her eyes and looked around the room, disoriented.
It's me, Kinsey. Can you hear me?
She mumbled something I couldn't understand.
Medora, did you take something for the pain? Let's get you up, okay?
I slid an arm under her head, trying to lift her into a sitting position.
I'm going to pull you up here, but I need your help.
She seemed to gather herself, pushing up on one elbow, which enabled me to haul her upright. Her gaze settled on mine with an expression of confusion.
What's happening?
I don't know, Medora. You tell me. Let's get you on your feet and take a walk. Can you do that?
What for? I'm fine. I don't want to walk.
Well, sit then and let's talk. I don't want you falling asleep again. Did you take something?
A nap.
I know you took a nap, but your doors were wide open and I was worried about you. Did you take any pills?
Earlier.
How many? Show me what you took. Was it this?
And the other ones.
I checked the labels on the bottles. Valium, Tylenol with codeine, Percocet, Xanax.
This is not a good idea. You're not supposed to take all of these at the same time, especially if you've had a drink. It's not safe. Are you feeling okay?
Dr. Belker gave me those.
But you shouldn't take them when you drink. Didn't he explain that?
That case, I couldn't take them at all. I drink every day.
She smiled at my goofiness, having settled that point. We went on in this fashion, with Medora offering short, declarative sentences in response to my continued questions. While it was hardly scintillating conversation, it did serve its intended purpose, which was to keep her in contact with reality. By the time Justine arrived, 15 minutes later, Medora was more alert and in control of herself. Justine shed her coat and tossed it on the back of a chair.
Sorry it took so long, but I was waiting for Cornell. I finally called my next-door neighbor, and she came over to watch the girls.
Medora had focused on Justine with an air of humility and embarrassment.
I didn't tell her to call you. I wouldn't do that.
Justine sat down beside her mother and took her hand.
How many times have we been through this, Mother? You can't keep doing this. I have a life of my own.
All I had was one drink and a pain pill.
I'm sure you did. How many?
The usual.
Never mind. Just skip it. I shouldn't waste my breath. Are you all right?
I'm fine. You didn't have to leave the girls and come over.
She says the doors were wide open. What was that about?
I closed them. I did. I remembered what you said.
Let's just get you into bed. We can talk about this later when you're more yourself.
I'm myself,
she said blearily, as Justine assisted her to her feet. Medora was a bit tottery. You need help? Justine shook her head, intent on maneuvering her mother around the sharp-cornered coffee table, across the room and into the short hallway that led to her bedroom. I could hear the two of them murmuring, Medora apologizing, while Justine went about the business of getting her to bed. 5 minutes later, Justine returned, rubbing her arms reflexively.
I swear she's getting worse. I don't know what to do with her. Jeez, the place is freezing.
It's warmer than it was. She went over to the thermostat.
It's turned off. What's she doing, trying to save money on the heating bill? No wonder she gets sick. She had pneumonia 2 months ago.
She adjusted the lever, and within seconds I could hear the furnace click on. She sat down on the couch with a sigh that was laden with irritation.
I can't tell you how many times I've talked to her about this.
She takes out the garbage or goes to pick up the newspaper from the drive, and then she either locks herself out or forgets to latch the door again. On a windy night like this, the doors bang and blow open. She never even knows.
I'm not sure that's what happened here, but it's giving me the creeps. Could you take a look around and make sure nothing's missing? Suppose someone's been here.
Why would anybody bother? There's nothing worth stealing.
I understand, but I don't like the feel of it. Can you make a quick circuit for my sake?
All right, you might as well follow me. This won't take long, but you can see for yourself.
She leaned over and picked up the whiskey bottle from the coffee table.
Here.
I took the bottle and waited while she snagged the highball glass and the pill bottles lined up nearby.
Her doctor's out of his mind. I've had this discussion with him 100 times. They're old friends, so she comes along right after me and talks him into it.
She gave the kitchen a cursory look while she poured her mother's whiskey down the drain. She emptied all the pills into the trash, where I heard them rattling toward the bottom like a cupful of BBs. She tossed in the empty whiskey bottle.
I'll take care of this later, she said, referring to the overflowing trash can and the pile of dishes in the sink. Things look fine in here. The place is a pigsty, but no more than usual.
I trailed after her while she looked into the bathroom and the second bedroom. The latter must have been her room as a kid, the one she'd been forced to share with Charisse. The twin beds were still in place, but most of the remaining space was taken up with piles of clothing, boxes, and miscellaneous junk. I nearly confided my suspicion about someone having entered my room, but I thought better of it. I didn't have proof, and I didn't want to sound completely paranoid. Besides, it would only encourage her to ask questions I didn't want to answer. As we were returning to the living room, she said,
I heard about Pudgy. It's horrible.
News travels fast.
Trust me, everybody knows by now.
Who told you?
Todd Chilton called. He's a deputy.
I met him. Why did he call you?
Oh, right. He remembered I dated Pudgy, and he thought I should know.
From what he said, it was gross. At least I got that impression reading between the lines.
He says you're the one who figured it out.
Someone would have noticed before long, I said, thinking about the smell. I filled in a few brush strokes, avoiding anything of substance. I was certain Detective Lassiter would limit the information that reached the public.
Why'd you stop by?
I had a question for your mom. I know this seems minor, but I was curious. The first time I talked to her, she said she'd gone to the police the day Charisse disappeared. But according to the police report, she waited a week. I was hoping she'd explain the discrepancy.
She didn't tell you about the note?
From Charisse? Not that I remember.
She probably forgot to mention it. Her mind's completely shot from all the crap she takes. The note said she decided to go see her mother and she'd be back in 3 days. We thought she'd show up, but a week passed and Mom started getting worried. That's when she talked to the police.
You saw the note yourself?
Sure, she left it on the bed.
And the handwriting was hers?
As far as I could tell.
Did your mother save it?
I doubt it. Why would she do that?
Could you ask her, please?
Right now?
I'd appreciate it. She left the living room and returned to her mother's bedroom, where I could hear her insistent questioning and Medora's foggy response. I heard drawers being opened and shut. Moments later, Justine returned.
I don't believe this. She says she saved the note because she didn't want social services blaming her when Charisse took off. She thought if they ever asked, she could show the note as proof that Charisse left of her own accord.
Amazing. That's great. I'd love to see it.
Well, that's just it. She can't remember where she put it. She thought it was in the chest of drawers, but it's not there now.
Knowing her, it could be anywhere. She's such a slob. Maybe we can look again when she's on her feet. Justine gave me a look.
Yeah, right. Listen, I need to get back to the girls. Cornell must be home by now, but just in case, let me turn off some lights and I'll walk you to your car. It's dark as pitch out there.
I waited while she double-checked, making sure the back door was locked. She turned off the lights except for one in the hall. She tested the thumb lock on the front door, flipped it to the locked position, and pulled it shut behind her. She took her keys from her coat pocket and crossed the yard to her Ford sedan, which was parked in the driveway behind Dolan's car. "Did you guys go down and have your fingerprints taken?" "Edna went Monday, but I haven't had a chance. I'll pop in tomorrow while I'm out running errands." "What about the others?" "Adrian said she'd try later in the week." "What about Rule and Cornell?" "Don't look at me. I don't want to be the one to nag them. It's not my job." "You're right. Thanks anyway. I'll bug them myself." I drove to the motel with an eye on my rear-view mirror. The wide streets were deserted. Businesses were shut down and most of the houses were dark. Once in my room, I spent a few minutes assuring myself everything was exactly as I'd left it. My book was face down on the bed where I'd placed it, the bedspread still rumpled where I'd pushed it aside. The table lamp was on, and the warm light made the room seem cozy. The windows were latched, and I made sure the drapes were properly closed. Didn't want any booger men to peek in at me. After that, I stripped out of my clothes and into the oversized t-shirt I use as a nightie. I washed my face, brushed my teeth, and slid into bed. I thought my paranoia might keep me awake, but since I'm a person of no depth, whatever, I fell asleep right away. At 2:06, the phone rang. I reached for the handset automatically, noting the time as I placed it against my ear. "What?"
"Kinsey?"
"What?"
"This is Iona."
"Okay."
"Frankie wants to talk to you."
"About what?"
"Pudgy."
"Put him on."
"In person."
I leaned over and flipped on the table lamp, which made me squint painfully and probably put permanent wrinkles on my face.
"Why are you calling me in the dead of night? I'm asleep." "I would have called earlier, but he just got here."
"Got here where?"
"Quorum. He wants you to meet us at the all-night diner. Know the one I mean? On Main Street? It's called the Chow Hound."
I closed my eyes. "No offense here, but there's no way I'm going out at this hour to talk to Frankie Miracle, so scratch that idea."
"What if he comes there? We're calling from a pay phone. We're not far."
"Like how far?"
"A block."
"Why isn't he on the phone instead of you?"
"He's afraid you'll say no."
I laughed.
"He's worried about me? Iona, the guy's a killer. He stabbed a woman 14 times. But he's paid for his crime. He went to prison and now he's out."
"Oh, crap. Why am I arguing with you? If you want to come over, I'll open the window and talk to him through the screen. That's as much as I can offer."
"Okay."
I hung up and went into the bathroom to brush my teeth. This was not the kind of hotel that offered complimentary robes. Hell, I felt lucky they offered complimentary toilet paper. So I pulled on a sweatshirt. I thought about it briefly and pulled on my jeans. By then, I could see headlights arc across the drapes. I turned off the lamp and crossed to the window, peering out as Frankie's white pickup pulled into a slot two doors down. Iona was at the wheel. She waited in the truck with the engine running, probably trying to keep warm, while Frankie got out on the passenger side and slammed the door. I said, "Great, wake everybody up, I'll feel safer that way." I watched him check room numbers until he got to mine. As soon as he was close, I slid the window open a crack. "Hello, Frankie."
"Hi. Can I come in?"
"No."
"Come on. I can't stand around out here. It's fucking cold."
"I don't need a weather report. I know it's cold. You want to talk? I'm listening, but get on with it."
"All right," he said irritably.
He paused to light a cigarette. Despite the low-watt outside lighting, I could see him clearly. The brown, wavy hair, the smooth, baby face. He peered over his shoulder, his manner embarrassed.
"I heard about